Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, the 5th of October. I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and this is IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services for the Blind and the Disabled. Dyersville manufacturer breaks ground. Officials celebrate the 26.5 million Ancient Brands milling facility. In Dyersville, one of the largest projects ever in the Dyersville area is underway. Ancient Brands Milling is relocating to Dyersville 20 West Industrial Park and constructing a 92,000 square foot, $26.5 million facility. A groundbreaking celebration for the project was held on Tuesday at the site, though a partial skeleton of the new building is up already. Whenever I drive by the site, I marvel at the outstanding progress being made, Mayor Jeff Jacques said. When you live in Iowa, especially Dyersville, this is who we are and why we all work together to turn dreams into a reality. Ancient Brands Milling manufactures organic and non-GMO puffed grains that are gluten-free and allergen-free, in addition to co-manufacturing products such as cereal, granola, energy bars, and plant-based alternatives for products. At the groundbreaking Ancient Brands Milling, Vice President of Supply Chain Tim Hebinger recalled coming up with the idea for a puffed grain manufacturer 8 years ago in Denver. Puffed grain was something no one really knew about, he said. It wasn't really in the U.S. That sparked the idea that this was something we needed to figure out, and I couldn't think of someone better than my brother, Patrick Hebinger, president of Ancient Brands Milling. Patrick Hebinger said that the company started as Ancient Brands Grains in 2015. He recalled working in Chicago, asking his children to be quiet while he was on the phone with suppliers. In 2020, the Hebingers met Wolfgang Bueller, who became their senior business partner and has past experience in the food manufacturing business. Bueller, who is originally from Germany, currently lives near Pasadena, California. The company bought assets from the Anderson Incorporated in 2020 and moved into the former Anderson's location in Dyersville Northwest Industrial Park. As our vision continues to manifest itself in Dyersville, we plan to continue having a strong contribution in the community, Patrick Hebinger said. We came to the Field of Dreams and we're about to go the distance. The new facility will increase Ancient Brands milling capacity from 2.5 million pounds of puffed product to 30 million pounds. Bueller added that two state-of-the-art puffing systems will be part of the new facility, which will be unique to North America. He noted that most puffed grains currently are made in Europe. Weather permitting, we hope to see you in the summer for the grand opening and be fully operational by the third quarter of 2023, he says. Hebinger said that the company plans to add at least 17 new jobs when the new facility opens. Currently, 17 employees work at Ancient Brands Milling in Dyersville. Tim Hebinger added that the company has had an impact globally, helping build schools in India, where the company sources some of its products. We're excited to share our impact in Dyersville, he says. We very much look forward to spreading our impact and platform to the community. The project previously received incentives from both state and local entities. Iowa Economic Development Authority awarded Ancient Brands Milling $769,093 in tax credits and refunds in May. A requirement of the award was the creation of the 17 new jobs at a qualifying wage of $22.63 per hour. Last month, Dyersville City Council members approved an agreement with the company for $2 million in tax increment rebates over a 10-year period beginning in 2025. Steve Salter, president of the Dyersville Economic Development Corporation Board of Directors, said on Tuesday marked an important day for the community and noted that Ancient Brands Milling will be one of the last companies located in the second phase of 20 West Industrial Park, which began a decade ago. We're working on phase three right now, he says, gesturing to where crews were working on aligning a road to extend it to the west. Phase 2 has one lot left, right to the west of Ancient Brands Milling. Dubuque Chief lauds tasers as additional tool for police officers. The department gives an update on the use of the stun guns since officers began carrying them in July. Dubuque Police Department leaders this week provided an update on the early months of officers carrying tasers. Police Chief Jeremy Jensen told City Council members that all 93 police officers have received their tasers and can carry them during their shifts. The first officers began carrying the stun guns in July. Since that time, there have been 8 incidents during which officers have drawn tasers from holsters and 2 cases in which a taser was fired. One of those uses only partially hit the target. The funding for officers' tasers was approved by City Council members as part of the fiscal year 2023 budget. Over the next 5 years, the city will pay a total of $378,800 for the purchase and maintenance of the tasers. Tasers are a brand of stun gun, which fires metal darts at an individual and then runs electricity through them to incapacitate them. Jensen said that the tasers provide a less lethal method for subduing violent suspects compared to firearms, and said that they should lead to fewer officers being injured. In 2021, 392 use of force reports were filed by Dubuque police officers, with 67% of those involving the use of bodily force. It just gives us an additional tool where we don't have to jump to a more lethal option, Jensen says. It's going to be more safe for our officers and our residents. He said that every officer who received a taser went through a full day of training and had to pass a written certification exam and functional test. Officers will have to be recertified annually. Additionally, officers were given the option to get shot by a taser to understand what it feels like. Jensen said about 40 officers took up the offer, himself included. I can tell you that it does not feel good, he said. And in other news, retailers set for spooky season. Local stores and businesses allowing for Halloween-themed activities are anticipating high traffic this holiday. A slew of Sarahs, a multitude of Marys, and a whole lot of Winfreds are expected to take to area streets this Halloween as hocus-pocus-themed costumes make a comeback following the recent release of the film sequel. Local retailers say that the 3 cinematic witches are some of this year's most popular costumes, along with other recent pop culture icons and timeless year-to-year favorites. Robert Gattina, assistant manager at Spirit Halloween's Dubuque location, said other popular picks included Grecian togas and cowboys. He also expects to see more costumes from the video games Sonic the Hedgehog and Stranger Things, the hit Netflix show that released its 4th season this summer. You've got Hocus Pocus, you've got Nightmare Before Christmas, and the classic horror movie people, he says. Finding the right costume, it's about comfort and functionality and finding something people want to wear. Katina said that some customers already have stopped in to purchase costumes at the seasonal store, which this year is located in Ashbury Plaza, but most of the early traffic has been people looking for decorations. And let's now go to the Dubuque and Tri-State page of the paper. Work continues on Grant County fiber optic communication projects. Planned improvements include 10 new emergency radio towers and 172-mile fiber optic loop. In Lancaster, Wisconsin, work is progressing on a large communications and fiber optic project in southwest Wisconsin. Grant County supervisors received updates on the project Tuesday at their monthly meeting. Planned improvements include the construction of 10 radio towers for emergency communications and the installation of a 172-mile fiber optic loop. Project co-leader Shane Drinkwater told the supervisors that the work is going well at the first 4 construction sites located in Plantville, Fenimore, Muscobel, and Skoda. Next year, work will begin on 6 more sites in the western Grant County. Installation of the fiber optic loop is slightly outpacing the construction of the new towers, but County Board Chairman Bob Keeney said that the entire project should be completed in 2025. Keeney described the project as being under budget so far. The project originally was budgeted for nearly $16 million in total, but he said that the county saved more than $100,000 by taking bids for the first round of tower construction with hopes for additional savings moving forward. The addition of the towers and fiber optic loop will be helpful for a few reasons, including public safety and broadband access, he said. We don't have adequate coverage of our radio systems right now, so that's first advantage in adding towers, said Keeney, a former fire chief. The second advantage is we're putting in the loop, so eventually we'll see internet connectivity at rapid speeds. Drinkwater said that the 172-mile fiber optic line will run intentionally near institutions that could particularly benefit from the high-speed internet, such as schools or government buildings. While the county won't provide internet directly, the goal is that the added infrastructure will attract additional providers. The concept is that we are improving the return on investment for internet service providers to get into the county, Drinkwater says after the meeting, instead of a private company having to find a way to get service from Platteville to Lancaster, for example, we can say, hey, we have fiber going that way. Project co-leader Sheriff Nate Dreckman told supervisors that the foundation is being poured for two radio towers in northern Grant County, and that work is going to acquire land for a few remaining sites. Well, let's see. What else is going on here? Maquoketa, Iowa. Case sent to juvenile court for teen accused of gun theft. The case for a Dubuque County teen accused of stealing firearms from a Maquoketa store has been waived to juvenile court. Casey J. Jones, age 17, of Bernard, was charged in Iowa District Court of Jackson County with second-degree burglary, trafficking in stolen weapons used in a crime, second-degree theft, possession of burglar tools, and fourth-degree criminal mischief. Jones was charged automatically as an adult in the case due to a state law that automatically tries 16- and 17-year-old offenders as adults if they are accused of serious crimes. Jackson County Attorney Sarah Davenport confirmed that Jones' case was waived to juvenile court. A motion for the waiver was filed in August. Jones was one of three people charged in connection with the July 3rd theft of five firearms from Thiessen's Home Farm Auto in Maquoketa. Manu C. Mack Dwyer, age 22, of Maquoketa, and Nicholas P. Williams, age 28, of Lost Nation, both are charged with one count each of second-degree burglary and second-degree theft. They have pleaded not guilty. Court documents state that Mac Dwyer admitted to driving a vehicle that dropped Jones off near Thiessen's on July 3rd. Documents state that Jones broke a window with rocks to get inside. He then broke a glass display case with another rock and stole five handguns. Jones was seen on camera leaving the store at about 3:10 a.m. Williams took possession of the firearms after the theft, documents go on to say. Police later received tips reporting that Jones bragged about the theft and that he had pictures on Facebook with the firearms, documents state. Documents state that Jones and Kenneth B.W. Judd, age 17, of Baldwin, were in a garage in Maquoketa on July 5th when Judd was trying to make a video with Jones holding a firearm. Documents state that a snapshot video shows Judd laughing while Jones held the handgun and talked about being shot by Judd. Judd is charged as an adult in Iowa District Court of Jackson County with reckless use of a firearm causing serious injury. He has pleaded not guilty. Now, let's take a look at some news brief stories. Authorities identify a man who was killed in Dubuque County as a tractor accident in Sherrill, Iowa. Authorities on Tuesday identified the driver of a tractor who died from injuries sustained when it rolled over Sunday in the Sherrill area. Thomas Schmidt, age 43, of Dubuque, suffered fatal injuries in the accident, according to the Dubuque County Sheriff's Department. A press release states that accident occurred at about 7:40 p.m. on Sunday at 13797 Hammerand Road. The tractor rolled over, pinning Schmidt. Schmidt was extricated, taken by ambulance to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, and later pronounced dead. Authorities are investigating the accident. Authorities, Royal Dubuque man throws knife at man, threatens to cut his heart out. Authorities said that a man threatened to cut another man's heart out before throwing a knife at him outside of Dubuque. Richard Haas, age 66, of 9442 Noonan Street, number 713, was arrested at 11 p.m. on Monday near his residence on charges of assault while displaying a dangerous weapon, first-degree harassment, and fourth-degree criminal mischief. Court documents state that the Dubuque Sheriff's Department deputies responded at about 10 p.m. on Monday to the residence of Jesse L. Birch, age 42, of 9442 Noonan Street, number 717. Birch said that Haas cut the seat of Birch's motorcycle while it was parked in front of Birch's residence and then confronted Birch with the knife in the driveway. Haas then told Birch, "I'm going to cut your heart out," documents state. Birch retreated under carport and Haas threw the knife at him. Documents state that surveillance camera footage shows that Haas holding a knife while taking a fighting stance in close proximity to Birch, and then Haas forcefully throws the knife in the same direction Birch retreated. Joe Davis, county state's attorney, sues over law eliminating cash bail. In Geneva, Illinois, Joe Davis County State Attorney Chris Allendorf has joined a group of his peers in the state filing suit over the elimination of cash bail and the Safety Act, signed by Governor J.B. Pritzker last year. The act abolishes cash bail in Illinois starting January 1st and provides for a presumption in favor of release for people suspected of many felony offenses, other than the most serious ones, misdemeanors, traffic offenses, other petty offenses, providing a judge provides and determines that the person is not at risk to a specific person or people. Judges cannot consider potential risk to the community in determining whether a person is detained. And let's look at some police news. The Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Department has reported the following. Michael R. Ropicki, age 44, of East Dubuque, Illinois, was arrested at 9:50 a.m. on Monday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on warrants charging probation violation and voluntary absence from custody. Court documents state that Ropicki did not return to the state correctional facility at 1494 Elm Street on June 16th. Courtney L. Sieverding, age 38, of 2310 Windsor Avenue, reported the theft of a $999 smartphone between September 26 and 10:15 a.m. Monday from her residence. Joseph A. Halpert, age 64, of 1490 Tower Drive, number 3, reported a burglary resulting in the theft of items worth $1,200 between August 30th and noon Sunday at his residence. Alliant Energy announces plans for battery storage facility in Grant County. A utility company recently announced plans to add 175 megawatts of battery storage in Wisconsin with one of the facilities in Grant County. Alliant Energy filed its proposed plan with Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, according to a press release. It states that the battery storage facilities will be developed in Grant and Wood counties alongside two previously approved solar arrays belonging to the utility. The Grant County 100-megawatt project will be located in Potosi. The utility said that the finished project could store enough energy to power more than 100,000 homes for 4 hours. Alliant plans to begin construction on the project in 2023, pending regulatory approval. The project could be completed by the fall of 2025. And another tri-state news, TH Parent Company makes two acquisitions in Wisconsin. WCI purchases pair of business publications. Two acquisitions in Wisconsin by Woodward Community Communications Incorporated, the parent company of the Telegraph Herald, were announced on Tuesday. Magna Publications Incorporated of Madison announced that it sold In Business to WCI. The sale includes In Business print and digital publications and related events. WCI CEO President Tom Woodward and In Business Associate Publisher Ellen Cameron will lead In Business while it seeks a new publisher, according to a press release. All of In Business's employees will be retained. We're very excited about this opportunity as it aligns well with our strategy and purpose of providing quality local content and services that support and grow strong communities, Woodward said in the release. WCI also announced that it acquired Insight Publications, LLC of Appleton, Wisconsin. The company was founded in 2007, and co-founder Brian Rasmussen has been the sole owner since 2018. He'll continue in his role as publisher, and all Insight Publication employees will be retained, the release states. The company's products include Insight on Business and Insight on Manufacturing, which serves an 18-county region in northeast Wisconsin. Insight also hosts an array of events. Well, now it's time to get hungry. Making Colt's Chocolates a regional hit in Chicago. Next time you wander through the specialty food aisle in Whole Foods, you might want to look for the Colt's name for a product with regional ties. And no, it's nothing to do with the Indianapolis football team. This Colt's has everything to do with chocolate and the myriad ways one can enrobe chocolate around things such as almonds, salted caramel, peanut butter, and graham crackers. This is, after all, Colt Chocolate Company, handcrafted in Tennessee, owned by former Chicagoland area family members Dirk Peterson, Michael Doherty, and Chris Smith, and Ashley Quinn, a friend of Peterson's and St. Louis native. Their signature products range from Colt's Bolts, a pucker-sized peanut butter cup with all-natural peanut butter topped with almonds and sandwiched between layers of chocolate, Bolt's Bites, which are golf ball-sized versions of the Bolt, and Marie McGee's Bumblebees, the Colt's take on a turtle. We bill our products as a modern twist on classic chocolates, said Peterson, a civil engineer by trade, now partner in Dolt's Chocolates. Think, for example, fudge brownies, but layered with whiskey-infused caramel and ganache. It's something like you've never, ever tasted before, he said. Super rich. The bumblebees are studded with roasted pecans and salted caramel. Graham cracker crumbs are baked in butter and blanked with chocolate for their Broadway grahams. It gives a really soft texture and a really soft bite, like the crust of a cheesecake, Peterson says. It's something you've never tasted. You just change a little bit of the ingredients to make it just that much better, and people love it. The chocolate is sourced from the Barry Calabout facility in the Southwest Side neighborhood of Archer Heights, part of a Switzerland-based chocolate company with its U.S. headquarters in Chicago. A change in production brought on by the new owners. Peterson, a former Barrington, Illinois resident and LaPorte, Indiana native, bought the Nashville-based Colt's in September 2018 with his cousin Doherty, an Elmhurst native, and Smith, his wife's uncle from the McHenry area. The family members saw Colt's Chocolate, founded in 1984 by Mackenzie Colt, a cast member of the former TV series Hee-Haw, as an investment idea. While small, Colt's was doing sales with the high six figures with its award-winning recipes, he said. After rebrand and a move to a new factory, Colt's products moved from four whole stores in Tennessee to hundreds of stores around the nation and soon the Fresh Market locations. Doherty, a River North resident and Fenwick High School alumnus, said it all started with the Elmhurst Whole Foods. I was thinking if we could get into at least the Midwest region of Whole Foods. I've got a pretty good foothold as far as family and friends and school connections were. If we get the word out, people will be able to recognize the Colt brand, said Doherty. A former BMO Harris employee, I think we got added in June to all the stores in the Midwest. It's been really cool to see a chocolate brand from Nashville get welcomed in the Chicago area. All of our family and friends have been really excited to see the brand name come into stores. Well, it's always important to take care of our health. Here is a column by Michael Roizen. The American Psychological Association's Stress in America poll reveals that 87% of U.S. adults feel high pressure from a perfect storm of rising prices, the war in Ukraine, and the pandemic and its aftermath. As if that pressure weren't harmful enough to the nation's health, consider this. Almost 9 million adults ages 35 to 64 have undiagnosed stage 1 high blood pressure. That's a top systolic number of 130 over 139 and a bottom systolic number of 80 to 89. Although the immediate risks are low, when untreated, it can creep into heart-stopping, brain-damaging stage 2 and stage 3. How much better would it be to nip it in the bud without the need for medication? New guidelines from research presented at the American Heart Association's Hypertension Scientific Session 2022 shows that adopting the DASH diet is the best way to reverse stage 1 high blood pressure. Other important preventative measures that you want to do simultaneously include avoiding heavy alcohol consumption and exercising regularly. If lots of folks with stage 1 high blood pressure followed these suggested self-care steps, it could prevent nearly 26,000 cardiovascular disease events, 2,900 deaths, and save about $1.6 billion in associated healthcare costs over 10 years. So, get your blood pressure checked, and if it's elevated, dash out to stock up on fruits, vegetables, skinless chicken, salmon, nuts, seeds, and 100% whole grains. Ditch red meat, sugars, and sugar-sweetened beverages. Limit your salt intake. Get your 10,000 steps or the equivalent daily, and only occasionally sip that glass of wine with dinner. All right, let's now go to the other side of the country, to the East Coast, to Washington, D.C. Trump asked Supreme Court to intervene in Mar-a-Lago case. Lawyers for former President Donald Trump asked the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday to step into the legal fight over the classified documents seized during an FBI search of his Florida estate, escalating a dispute over the powers of an independent arbiter appointed to inspect the records. The Trump team asked the justices to overturn a lower court, ruling and allow the arbiter, called a special master, to review the roughly 100 documents with classification markings that were taken in the August 8th search of Mar-a-Lago. A three-judge plan from the Atlanta-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit last month limited the special master's review to the much larger tranche of non-classified documents. The judges included two Trump appointees, sided with the Justice Department, which had argued that there was no legal basis for the special master to conduct his own review of the classified records. But Trump's lawyers said that in their application to the Supreme Court that it was essential for the special master to have access to the classified region or records, rather, to determine whether documents bearing classification markings are in fact classified, and regardless of classification, whether those records are personal records or presidential records. Since President Trump had absolute authority over classification decisions during his presidency, the current status of any disputed document cannot possibly be determined solely by reference to the markings on that document, the application states. It says that without special master review, the unchallenged views of the current Justice Department would supersede the established authority of the chief executive. An independent review, the Trump team says, ensures a transparent process that provides much needed oversight. The FBI says it seized roughly 11,000 documents, including about 100 with classification markings, during its search. The Trump team asked a judge in Florida, Eileen Cannon, to appoint a special master to do an independent review of the records. Cannon subsequently assigned a veteran Brooklyn judge, Raymond Deary, to review the records and segregate those that may be protected by claims of attorney-client privilege and executive privilege. She also barred the FBI from being able to use the classical documents as part of its criminal investigation. And I would like to remind you that you're listening to IRIS, which is Iowa Radio Reading Information Services for the Blind and the Disabled. And this is Peter Welch speaking to you here today on the 5th of October. And I am reading the Telegraph Herald. Now, let's go to some obituary news. In Green Bay, Wisconsin, Mary Elizabeth Pierce has passed away at the age of 95. In lieu of plants and flowers, a Mary E. Pierce Memorial Fund has been established. Memorials may be mailed to Haudenschild, let me spell that, Haudenschild Funeral Home, care of Mary Pierce Family, Box 825, Cuba City, Wisconsin, 53807. And James P. McCray, age 81, has passed on September 1st. In lieu of plants and flowers, memorials in Jim's name may be given to St. Rose Church, Cuba City, Wisconsin, the Dominican Sisters in Sinsinawa, Wisconsin, or Area Residential Care in Dubuque, Iowa. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.howdenschildfuneralhome.com. Linda S. Ledke has passed at the age of 73 in Coralville, Iowa, and died on October 1st at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Visitation will be at Christ the King Lutheran Church at 325 Mormon Trek Boulevard in Iowa City, Iowa, at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, October 12th, with a memorial service to follow at 11 a.m. A lunch will be served following the service. And in lieu of flowers, memorial contributions in memory of Linda may be made to support the School of Social Work Development Fund at the University of Iowa, payable to the University of Iowa Center for Advancement, Post Office Box 4550, Iowa City, Iowa 52244. Marie Kalb has passed on the 4th of October. The Sisters of St. Francis express their thanks to Hospice of Dubuque for their care and concern. Memorials may be given to the Sisters of St. Francis Dubuque, Iowa. Leo Hillard, age 97, of Venice, Florida, and formerly Galena, Illinois, has passed on Monday, the 5th of September, in Sarasota. A funeral mass will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday on the 8th of October at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Galena, where friends may call after 10 a.m. until the time of Mass. Burial will be in the church cemetery. And, of course, one of country music's greatest singers and country stars has passed, and I'm talking, of course, about Loretta Lynn. And there's a picture here of Loretta with the president, Barack Obama, back in 2013, where she was getting the Presidential Medal of Freedom. In Nashville, Tennessee, Loretta Lynn, the Kentucky coal miner's daughter, whose frank songs about life and love as a woman in Appalachia pulled her out of poverty and made her a pillar of country music, has died. She was 90 years of age. In a statement provided to the Associated Press, Lynn's family said that she died Tuesday in her home in Hurricane Mills, Tennessee. Our precious mom, Loretta Lynn, passed away peacefully this morning on the 4th of October in her sleep at home in her beloved ranch in Hurricane Mills. They asked for privacy as they grieve, and said a memorial will be announced later on. Lynn already had four children before launching her career in the early 60s, and her songs reflected her pride and in her rural Kentucky background. As a songwriter, she crafted a persona of a defiantly tough woman, a contrast to the stereotypical image of most female country singers. The Country Music Hall of Famer wrote fearlessly about sex and love and cheating husbands and divorce and birth control and sometimes got in trouble with radio programmers for material from which even rock performers once shied away. She and her husband were married nearly 50 years before he passed in 1996. They had six children. And they are Betty, Jack, Ernst, and Clara, and then twins Patsy and Peggy. She had 17 grandchildren and four step-grandchildren. All right, let's now turn to some more international news. North Korea sends missile over Japan. In Seoul, South Korea, North Korea conducted its longest ever weapon test Tuesday, a nuclear-capable ballistic missile that flew over Japan and could reach the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam and beyond, forcing the Japanese government to issue evacuation alerts and halt trains. The South Korean and U.S. militaries responded by launching fighter jets that fired weapons at a target off South Korea's west coast in a show of strength against North Korea. The North Korean missile launch was at its most provocative weapons demonstration this year, as it pushes to develop a full-fledged nuclear arsenal capable of threatening the U.S. mainland and its allies, with the goal of wresting concessions from these countries, some experts say. The U.S., Britain, France, Albania, Norway, Ireland called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. Diplomats said it's likely to be held today, but it's not certain whether it will be open or closed. North Korea has test-fired about 40 missiles over about 20 different launch events this year, as its leader Kim Jong-un refuses to return to nuclear diplomacy with the U.S. The U.S. strongly condemned North Korea's dangerous and reckless decision to launch what it described as a long-range ballistic missile over Japan. Well, of course, we're all aware of the enormous damage that was done in Florida after Hurricane Ian. And here's a story about that. And this is in Bonita Springs, Florida. Workers are trying to restore service and search for anyone still trapped after the powerful hurricane. In the aftermath of Hurricane Ian, workers on the ground were pushing ahead Tuesday to restore power and search for anyone still trapped inside flooded or damaged homes in Florida. The number of storm-related deaths has risen to at least 80 in recent days, both because of the dangers posed by cleaning up and as search and rescue crews comb through the hardest-hit areas. Officials said that as of Monday, more than 2,350 people had been rescued throughout the state, or I should say throughout the state. At least 71 people were killed in Florida, 5 in North Carolina, 3 in Cuba, and 1 in Virginia since Ian made landfall on the Caribbean island on September 27th, a day before it reached Florida's Gulf Coast. After churning northeastward into the Atlantic, the hurricane made another landfall in South Carolina before pushing into the mid-Atlantic states. There have been deaths in vehicle wrecks, drownings, and accidents. A man drowned after becoming trapped under a vehicle. Another got trapped trying to climb through a window. And a woman died when a gust of wind knocked her off her porch while she was smoking a cigarette as the storm approached, authorities said. A hardest hit Lee County, Florida, all 45 people killed by the hurricane were over age 50. As floodwaters begin to recede, power restoration has become job one. In Naples, Kelly Sedwick was just seeing news footage Monday of the devastation. Her electricity was restored 4 days after the hurricane slammed into her community of roughly 22,000 people. She praised the crews for their hard work. They've done a remarkable job. A few miles north along the coast in Bonita Springs, Catalina Magilia's family wasn't as lucky. She was still using a borrowed generator to try to keep her kids and her grandfather cool as temperatures in the typically humid area reached the upper 80s. "The heat's unbearable," Magilia said. "When there's no power, we can't make food. We don't have gas. Her mother has trouble breathing and needed to go to a friend's house with electricity." Ian knocked out power to 2.6 million customers across Florida after it roared ashore with 150-mile-an-hour winds and powerful storm surge. State officials said that they expect power to be restored by Sunday to customers whose power lines and other electric infrastructures are intact. About 400,000 homes and businesses in Florida were still without power on Tuesday. Eric Silge, chairman and CEO of Florida Power and Light, the largest power provider in the state, said that he understands the frustration and that 21,000 utility workers from 30 states are working as hard as they can to restore power as quickly as possible. The utility expects to have power restored to 95% of its service areas by the end of the day, Friday, he says. And now let's go over to Ukraine. Retreating Russians leave their comrades' bodies behind. Ukrainian president rules out negotiations after Russian government claims to annex territories. Russian troops abandoned a key Ukrainian city so rapidly that they left the bodies of their comrades in the streets, offering some evidence Tuesday of Moscow's latest military defeat as it struggles to hang on to four regions of Ukraine that it illegally annexed last week. Meanwhile, Russia's upper house of parliament rubber-stamped the annexations following referendums that Ukraine and its Western allies have dismissed as fraudulent. Responding to the move, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky formally ruled out talks with Russia, declaring that negotiations with Russian Vladimir President Putin are impossible after his decision to take over the region. The Kremlin replied by saying that it will wait for Ukraine to agree to sit down for talks, noting that it may not happen until a new Ukrainian president takes office. We will wait for the incumbent president to change his position and wait for a future Ukrainian president who would revise his stand in the interests of the Ukrainian people, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov went on to say. Despite the Kremlin apparent political bravado, the picture on the ground underscored the disarray Putin faces amid the Ukrainian advances and attempts to establish new Russian borders. Over the weekend, Russian troops pulled back from Lyman, a strategic eastern town that the Russians had used as logistic and transport hub to avoid being encircled by Ukrainian forces. The town's liberation gave Ukraine an important vantage point for pressing its offensive deeper into Russian-held territories. 2 days later, an Associated Press team reported from Lyman saw at least 18 bodies of Russian soldiers still on the ground. The Ukrainian military appeared to have collected the bodies of their comrades after fierce battles for control of the towns, but they did not immediately remove those of the Russians. We fight for our land, for our children, so that our people can live better. But all this comes at a very high price, said a Ukrainian soldier who goes by the nom de guerre Rudd. Speaking late Tuesday in his nightly video address, Zelensky said that dozens of settlements had been retaken from the Russian Poseidon referendum this week alone in the four annexed regions. The deputy head of the Russian-backed regional administration, Incursion, told Russian TV that Ukrainian troops made certain advances from the north and were attacking the regions from other sides too. He said that they were stopped by Russian forces and suffered high losses. Okay, let's return to the other side of the pond, back here in America. Going now to Atlanta, Georgia, report that Walker paid for abortion puts issue at center of Georgia race. In Atlanta, in Georgia's pivotal U.S. Senate race, Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and his Republican challenger Herschel Walker have each been laboring to cast the other as extremists on abortion while deflecting questions about the finer points of their own positions. The sidestepping by Warnock, who supports abortion rights, and Walker, who has called for a national ban, reflects the sensitivity of abortion politics in a post-Roe versus Wade America, where the procedure is open to regulation by state governments and potentially by Congress. But Walker's strategy may not work much longer after the Daily Beast reported Monday that the former University of Georgia and NFL football star encouraged and paid for a girlfriend's abortion in 2009, a blatant contradiction of his staunch claims that there's no excuse for a procedure he characterizes as a killing. Walker calls the report a flat-out lie. The story propelled the issue of abortion back to the center of the race in the closing weeks of the campaign and just ahead of the candidates' October 14th debate. The contest is one of the most consequential in the country this midterm season and could determine which party controls the Senate for the second half of President Joe Biden's first term in office. Abortion is an issue in other Senate races as well, including Colorado and North Carolina. The Daily Beast interviewed a woman who identified herself as a former girlfriend of Walker's and asked that her name not be disclosed out of concerns for her privacy. She provided a receipt indicating that she paid $575 for an abortion, as well as get well card from Walker, and bank deposit records show the image of a $700 personal check from Walker dated 5 days after the abortion receipt. At the least, the report complicates Walker's effort to use abortion as an issue against Warnock, and it underscores the sometimes delicate task that confronts other candidates from both major parties who hope to use the issue ahead of the midterm elections. For decades, under Roe, Republicans like Walker were able to call themselves pro-life and blast abortion on demand, perhaps even expressing support for absolute or near-total bans that federal courts were certain to strike down. Democrats, meanwhile, could oppose such Republican efforts as draconian. Politicians knew it would be the Supreme Court, not them, making any kind of ultimate decision. But with the High Court in June overturning the 1973 decision, legalizing abortion nationwide, the issue has become one of the animating variables of the 2022 midterm campaigns. The most conservative and anti-abortion groups want a national ban, with some going so far as to oppose even exceptions in cases involving rape, incest, or health risks to a pregnant woman. Abortion rights groups, meanwhile, are reticent to back any limits on abortion access, including later in pregnancy. As a whole, Americans have nuanced views on abortion, though a clear majority support at least some access. All right, now let's turn to some business. Deal back on? Musk gets closer to buying Twitter. Trading in shares of Twitter halted after the stock spikes on reports that Musk would proceed with his $44 billion deal to buy the company. The tumultuous saga of Elon Musk's on-again, off-again purchase of Twitter took a turn toward a conclusion Tuesday after the mercurial Tesla CEO proposed to buy the company at the originally agreed-on price of $44 billion. Musk made the surprising turnaround not on Twitter, as it had been in his custom, but in a letter to Twitter that the company disclosed in a filing Tuesday with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. It came less than 2 weeks before a trial between the two parties is scheduled to start in Delaware. In response, Twitter said it intends to close the transaction at $54.20 per share after receiving the letter from Musk, but the company stopped short of saying it's dropping its lawsuit against the billionaire Tesla CEO. Experts said that they make sense given the contentious relationship and lack of trust between the two parties. I don't think Twitter will give up its trial date on just Musk's word. It's going to need more certainty about closing, said Andrew Jennings, professor at Brooklyn Law School, noting that the company might also be worried about Musk's proposal being a delay tactic. After all, he's already tried to unsuccessfully postpone the trial twice. Trading in Twitter stock, which had been halted for much of the day pending release of the news, resumed trading late Tuesday and soared 22% to close at $52 a share. Poll: many pessimistic about improving standard of living. In New York, more than half of America believes it's unlikely that younger people today will have a better quality of life than their parents. According to a new poll from the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy and the AP Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, most of those polled said that raising a family, owning a home are important to them, but more than half said that those goals are harder to achieve compared with their parents' generation. That was particularly true for younger people. About 7 in 10 Americans under 30 think home ownership has become harder to achieve. About half of those polled also said it's hard for them to improve their own standards of living, while many citing both economic conditions and structural factors. Joaquin Cano, age 39, a bus operator in Chicago who is Hispanic, said that he's having a harder time economically than his parents. He mentioned inflation and high housing costs and the recent baby formula shortages as examples. Things have doubled and tripled in price, he said. We're not talking about gym shoes or concert tickets. We're talking about essentials. 6 months ago, you couldn't find Pediasure. And if you could find it, it would be $20. It used to be $11 at Target. Cano also pointed to the fact that the real purchasing power of the minimum wage was higher for previous generations and that rents and the cost of education were more reasonable. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the federal minimum wage in 2021 was worth 34% less than in 1968 when its purchasing power peaked. Compared with younger people, Americans age 60 or older are more likely to believe it's easier for them to achieve a good standard of living compared with their parents, the poll found. Only 35% of adults over 60 said it's much or somewhat harder to achieve a good standard of living, compared with 54% of adults aged 18 through 29. The poll also found that the Black Americans have a more positive outlook on upward mobility for future generations than white Americans. All right, let's look at some other news here. U.S. is to require more rest between shifts for flight attendants. Airlines will be required to give flight attendants at least 10 hours of off-duty between shifts, one more hour than currently under a rule announced on Tuesday by the Federal Aviation Administration. Acting FAA Administrator Billy Nolen said that the extra hour of rest would contribute to safety. The rule goes into effect in 30 days, and airlines have up to 90 days to comply. It took us way too long, but we are finally here, Nolen said at a news conference at Reagan Washington National Airport, where he was flanked by more than a dozen flight attendants. Current federal rules allow flight attendants to work up to 14 hours in a day and get 9 hours of rest between shifts. U.S. job openings sink as inflation persists. In Washington, the number of available jobs in the U.S. plummeted in August compared with July, a sign that businesses might pull back further on hiring and potentially cool chronically high inflation. There were 10.1 million advertised jobs on the last day of August, the government said on Tuesday, down a huge 10% from 11.2 million openings in July. And in March, job openings had hit a record of nearly 11.9 million. Layoffs ticked up in August, but remained at historically low level, and slightly more people quit their jobs. Goodwill gets serious with online for thrifters in New York. Thrifters who flock to Goodwill stores will now be able to do some serious treasure hunting online as well. The Goodwill Industries International Incorporated, the 120-year-old nonprofit organization that operates 3,300 stores in the U.S. and Canada, has launched an online business as part of a newly incorporated venture called Goodwill Finds. Until now, Goodwill had no centralized online business, with each store selling some of its donations online via third-party websites. Goodwill Finds launched Tuesday with roughly 100,000 items available online, and much more will be added, said Matthew Haynes, CEO of Goodwill Finds. GoodwillFinds.com features search tools that let shoppers browse by category, and eventually it will be able to personalize the site based on the customer's past purchases. Micron to bring microchip plant to New York. Micron, one of the world's largest microchip manufacturers, announced on Tuesday that it will open a semiconductor plant in upstate New York, promising a long-term investment of up to $100 billion and a plant that could bring 50,000 jobs to the state. The company was lured to the Syracuse area with help from a generous set of federal, state, and local incentives, including up to $5.5 billion in state local credits over 20 years. In addition to tax credits tied to investment and job creation, New York has pledged $200 million for road and infrastructure improvements where the plant is being built in suburban Clay, and $100 million to a community benefit fund. The state also will review supplying the operation with low-cost power. The company plans to invest up to $100 billion over the next 20-plus years to construct the projects, with the first investment of $20 billion planned by the end of the decade. The deal is also expected to bring more than 9,000 jobs to Micron, and officials believe it could also bring close to 40,000 other ancillary jobs to the region, from suppliers to contractors, officials said. And that does it for the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for October 5th. And I am your reader, Peter Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, Iowa Radio Information Services for the Blind and the Disabled. Thank you so much for listening today. Bye-bye now.